But that is not so. You have an entirely new attitude to what human beings are doing, which may be very creative, but which also may be very dangerous. You see through the game called white must win, because you know that neither black nor white are going to win, because they belong to each other. So one of the problems of the various chemicals which can change the human mind in certain ways so that it becomes apparent that inside and outside go together is that they do rather give the show away, and people who take these chemicals and see through the human game cannot be trusted. They may decide to be good sports and go back into the game and play it as if it were for real, or they may not. And if they don't, what's going to happen?
Good Sunday morning to you. You're listening to the Chris Hedges Report here on KPFK 90.7 FM. Chris has two conversations this morning. The first one is with David Hodges, a British traditional conservative, and they discuss the differences between traditional conservatism historically and neoconservatism, which has ruled the roost, particularly since the George W. Bush administration here in the United States in 2000. And then following that, Chris has a conversation with a comic and commentator Jimmy Dore. They discuss Donald Trump and whether he actually would stand up to the military-industrial complex and the so-called deep state. So please stay tuned, and if you enjoy these conversations, please support KPFK. Go to kpfk.org. Here is Chris Hedges.
Let's talk about 9/11, because 9/11 is a kind of epiphany for you. Explain what happened, why, and, you know, that was really the genesis, I think, of this book.
Yeah, it was. I mean, when you very kindly and generously introduced me, I just wanted to dispute one element of your interpretation of my journey,
I'm going to change the introduction, so tell me what I should change.
Yeah, I mean, curiously enough, I don't think that I was representing. You're right that I did write for quite a number of, almost every kind of well-known conservative publication in Britain. But I think that at that stage, they were truly conservative. I mean, in the sense that they represented an old-fashioned type of conservatism, which has no I don't think there's an equivalent in the United States. It's Burkean conservatism, you know, named after the sort of great polemicist and philosopher who created the idea of conservatism in the 18th century, supported the American Revolution, but called time when the French, he foresaw the terror in the French Revolution. It's based on a form of scepticism, a sort of a suspicion of grand ideas, this sort of conservatism. It's a bit, what's the right word? Patriarchal? No, it's not. You know, paternalistic is a better word. I think it is a bit like
Burke was a monarchist. We should be clear. He was a defender of the monarchy. Let me put it that way.
When the French Revolution came along, he felt that the monarchy, as I agree with him, I still agree with him, is a source of stability, or anyway, the form, the constitutional monarchy, which had evolved by the 18th century in Britain, was a stable form of government. I think he valued and understood stability because he feared war, and I think that's so. I might call myself a Burkean conservative, and that is the form of conservatism which survives in Britain right up to the late 20th century, from the time when Burke was writing his great masterpieces. But what the central thesis of this book is that British conservatism gets captured by something called neoconservatism, which is not, despite its name, is not conservative at all. It's an American, it's imported from the United States, and it has its origins on the left, and it is about great schemes, such unwise projects, of which one of them was the invasion of Iraq. It doesn't believe in the rule of law. It really sees the whole world as some sort of carnal house where you need to win. You have power, might is right. I think it's a very dark analysis of how the world is. And it crossed the Atlantic before 2001, and it persuaded Tony Blair to join George W. Bush in the invasion of Iraq, and that has defined the century ever since.
You worked, I just have to ask you, because it's in the book, you worked for Boris Johnson. What was your read of Johnson at the time? He was the editor where? The Spectator was
yeah, he hired me. He hired me in fact, in about 2001 at the Spectator. And he was a very, very good editor of the Spectator. He wasn't there all that much, but he was very open to ideas, great fun. He was one of the quickest minds of anyone I'd ever dealt with. He saw the story. If you're a journalist, to see a story, he saw the story at once. He'd seen everything when I explained an idea to him before I'd reached the end of the first sentence. It was remarkable. Which caused me rather to misjudge him a bit later, because he didn't progress from that situation. At that point, he was a liberal, a liberal metropolitan figure, cosmopolitan, I should say.
Let's talk about the difference between how traditional conservatives viewed Muslims and how neoconservatives view Muslims. Is there a difference?
Very much so. So if you look at Burke, it's devoted, as you will recollect, about 10 years of his life to standing up for human rights in India. He didn't agree with the British exploitation of India and abuses. The traditional conservatism of what is quite benign. It isn't really racist, I don't think. It's a little bit of management here. You try and deal with people collectively and enable them to flourish, but it isn't hostile, and it's very knowledgeable. It's a great tradition of British scholarship about Islam in the 19th and 20th centuries and before. As there is about other religions, and you get a tradition, the idea of the gentleman diplomat, the gentleman scholar who tries to manage, keep the world from falling apart, and keep the British Empire, of course, from falling apart. That I think is the traditional conservatism. There's a great figure called Pickthall in the 19th century who converted, as a number of British figures did. to Islam, and then
Richard Burton.
Richard Burton is another one, and actually they're the ancestors of Philby, who founded the Saudi, helped found, very instrumental in founding modern Saudi Arabia. Who is the wonderful lady who taught herself Arabic and went and sort of effectively ruled Iraq in the
1990s. Gertrude Bell.
Yeah.
Now, so let's talk about, talk about not only the difference, but how that switch was made.
The switch. It is still going on. There needs to be a very big book about it at some point. I lived through this, and it took me a while to understand. I think that a lot of it was done through think tanks. There was a think tank in this country called Policy Exchange, which did a lot of the heavy lifting, the cultivation of MPs and journalists. You found it easier suddenly to get those sort of ideas, you know, supporting the Iraq war, into the newspapers than you pieces opposing it. This idea was, the central idea of neoconservatism was that the world is divided between civilized and barbaric peoples. We, the Americans, and the British as a clan state, you know, you've got to keep civilization going. It was very incredibly ignorant, if you read the pieces, about the richness of the Islamic intellectual tradition. They wouldn't acknowledge it. It was very contemptuous of foreign countries and foreign peoples and foreign lives, I think we should say. There was no value attached really to the lives of people who opposed themselves. We stopped talking around this time. I think there's somebody you and I both know, Alistair Crook. You know Alistair? Probably, yeah. talk to him on this. I mean, he was thrown out of, it's reported, he's never told me this, but it's been written that he was thrown out of the British Secret Intelligence Service for talking to Hamas on the orders of Tony Blair. Now, my old-fashioned way of seeing the world, one of the jobs of an intelligence agent would be to speak to Hamas, you know, to terrorists or to resistance groups. That's that, and yet there seemed to be a closure at some point about 20 years ago. And if you want to understand what's going on today, you have to understand this very dangerous transformation in the process of thinking and dealing with abroad, which suddenly happened. The neoconservatives seems to have felt that the world should be like New York City. And with the values of New York City, the carelessness of New York City, and the greed of New York City, and the fun of it too. I'm not going to be completely negative about New York City, but they felt threatened if they went to Istanbul or to East Jerusalem or to Hebron or Damascus, it produces this awful language from George W. Bush, a disgusting figure in my view, who has done him, and his axis of evil and bumping blindly into a war, invading blindly a country he doesn't understand.
Would it be fair to characterize the old form of conservatism as paternalistic and the neoconservatives as provincialism?
I think they are intellectually provincial. If you start to look into the deep origins of it, I think it comes out, some of it out of despair at Weimar, you know, that the liberal, a sense that the liberal institutions just were incapable of standing up to the nightmare the Nazi nightmare, and really you had to abandon the commitment to representative democracy, due process, rule of law, and you had to fight. You had to use. It was kill or be killed, and I think that is part of the sense that the neoconservatives brought to the world it starts, doesn't it, in the sort of late 90s, the late 20th century, and then it becomes the ruling. It captures George W. Bush when he becomes president in 2000.
Yes, although it does capture Bush, but in essence, there's no deviation from that ideology through Barack Obama, through Biden, through
right.
Stammer, through
anyone
else.
No, it's still there. Yeah. It's absolutely still in control. And one of the fascinating things actually in Britain, and I suspect it's true too in the United States, that if you look at the people who gave us the Iraq War, which is still the greatest crime of the 21st century, there's a lot of competition now. They are still rewarded, they occupy high positions of state, whereas the opponents of the Iraq War, Jeremy Corbyn is the most notable in many ways now. In Britain, are forgotten and destroyed. And Corbyn, remember, was right again and again. The Stop the War movement, he was right about Afghanistan, he was right about, everybody agrees about this, Afghanistan, he was right about Iraq. He voted, one of the very few people who voted against the disastrous Libya intervention, and one of the very, very few parliamentarians who will stand up and talk about the atrocities now taking place, the horror in Gaza. He's one of the very few. That tradition has almost been wiped out. And so if you want to protest against Gaza now, you're right out there on the edges of public opinion. The Stop the War marches. You're risking your career now if you're an academic or a politician or a journalist.
Again, you're listening to the Chris Hedges Report here on KPFK, and this second conversation coming up, as I said, is with Jimmy Dore, the comic and commentator. Chris and Jimmy discussed Donald Trump and whether he would actually stand up to the military-industrial complex and the so-called deep state.
Well, it's where we live, Jimmy. Your circle is Hollywood and mine is Princeton, New Jersey. These are the people who profit from the system. They are the managerial class. They are the 1%. I think much of the country actually does see it. I teach in the prison system. Certainly all of my students and their families, most of whom don't vote because it doesn't make any difference whether it's Biden or Trump. We still run the largest carceral system in the world. It doesn't make any difference if you're a Palestinian, if it's Biden or Trump. And you touched on, I think, correctly, this yearning, which is real, the sense of betrayal, which is real, that is fueling Trump's candidacy. And of course, you're right. Trump is everything you said he is. But he is speaking in his own kind of distorted, disingenuous way to real issues. And I think one of the things that I found so chilling about the DNC is that they're not, it's not a, it wasn't a reality-based event. We always talk about Trump and magical thinking, but the Democratic Party wins the prize for magical thinking. They won't even accept not only will they not accept responsibility for what they did, they won't even acknowledge the reality that is literally outside their door.
Yeah. That was a great way to put it. It was not a reality-based event. That's a perfect way to put it. You know, I'm the only sliver of hope that you can, that I, you know, I try to find a sliver of hope. Otherwise, I'll just be depressed all day. And, you know, my sliver of hope is that, you know, Donald Trump always wants credit for deals, you know, like his big thing. And he didn't start a war. He did ramp up the drone war, and he did, you know, assassinate Soleimani. And he did move the embassy to drill. He did a lot of those types of things, but he didn't start a war. And I've asked a lot of people, why do you think that is? Why do you think he resisted bombing in Syria? And then when he did, he just bombed like a place that was inconsequential, and, you know, and why he put the pause on the arms to Ukraine. You know, so, and people, it's because my theory, again, this is my sliver of hope, is that he wants to be seen as the guy who solved problems, and he got the deal done, and he's all about deals. And I think he has a distaste for calling up Gold Star families and telling them that their kid is dead. I think as I've heard him described, that he's, you know, New York Wall Street, he's New York real estate evil. He's not deep state neocon evil. And so I think he does have a distaste for that. And I think that, you know, just like he had the over the top rhetoric with Kim Jong-un, if you remember, and then he was able to do a deal. It reminds me, like when I was a kid, I remember them saying, you know, because Nixon had spent his whole career being a red baiting maniac, that he was the only one who could go to China. I remember them all saying that, well, only Nixon could, because if anybody else went, he'd be immediate and, you know, created friendly relations. He would immediately be labeled a red and a lefty and a puppet. So hopefully that's Trump's strategy, is that he's like he did with Kim Jong-un, is he speaks so over the top, creating space for him to create a deal. I found an audio recording of Donald Trump when he first approached the Israel-Palestine issue. He thought the problem was going to be with the Palestinians not wanting a deal. And he found out that it was the Palestinians who did want a deal, and it was Bibi. In fact, in the recording, I think I'm quoting verbatim, he said, after about 3 minutes of talking, I said, Bibi, you don't want a deal, do you? And he said, So Trump kind of figured that out, and they did push the Abraham Accords. So that was, I think, his attempt to get a deal. And so maybe he has this over-the-top rhetoric so he can enforce some kind of a deal. Maybe he's got that rhetoric because he wanted to get the $100 million from Adelson's widow, which he got. And so maybe that creates space, right? And so he didn't have the space with Russia because he didn't talk tough against Russia, right? Because there was no reason for him to. I hope I'm being clear on what I'm saying. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm saying that's the only sliver of hope we have, because Kamala Harris is 100% in bed with the deep state and the military-industrial complex and Wall Street and the billionaire class and the WEF and the people who actually run things, right? Because she doesn't, just like Joe Biden isn't running things, she's not running things. She's being told what to do. So that's my only, I mean, you have to, the deep state is, they've been trying to get rid of Trump since he started, right? That's what Russiagate was about. That was collusion of the FBI, CIA, and the Hillary Clinton campaign and the media, to discredit him, get rid of him. That's what January 6th was. There were, you know, how many cops were in the crowd? How many were dressed as MAGA supporters inside the Capitol before the riot even started? The FBI won't tell you. So that was another psyop, right? I'm convinced a lot of those Black Lives Matter riots were inspired by the FBI to create chaos. Chaos always favors the establishment. They wanted to get rid of Donald Trump. And then the CIA lied for about the Hunter Biden laptop. And there was 50 of them on a letter. And so, but they're not doing that for Trump. So at some point, he is somehow a thorn in the side of the deep state and the military industrial complex. And like I said, I think it's because he has the stupid idea that the president is supposed to control the military and the intelligence community. And they are letting him know he is not in control, that there is a group of people who are in control. It is the deep state. It is not the president. And if you don't serve them, just like Chuck Schumer said to Rachel Maddow, right in camera, is that if you don't do what the deep state wants, they have 6 ways to Sunday to mess with you. And that means what Chuck Schumer revealed when he said that to Rachel Maddow was that the president doesn't control the CIA, that the CIA and the FBI and the NSA doesn't work for the president. And if they don't work for the president, the question then is, exactly who do they work for? Well, Rachel Maddow's never going to ask that follow-up question. She's never even going to point that out. But that's the obvious takeaway from that conversation that she had with Chuck Schumer, who at the time was the leading Democrat in the country. So that's the only sliver of hope, is that they're trying to kill him. So somebody's trying to kill him. And that's my, I know that sounds like a weird way to bring you hope, but that's it.
I think that's a fascinating truth. And it's clear that the leaks on Russiagate were coming from the intelligence community. And then all the former intelligence, Clapper and all these figures, could not be on MSNBC or any other network fast enough to accuse Trump of being a Russian asset. And it's anecdotal, so I don't want to pretend that it's fact, but I did speak to somebody who is close to Trump and told me that Trump's greatest fear is that the CIA will take him out. And I think that there is a great deal of truth to this antagonism. That doesn't, I don't share your sliver of hope with Trump. I'm just completely bleak. But that is a fascinating, dynamic, because, of course, the CIA is, like the military, it's uncontrollable. There's a historian, Arnold Toynbee, who writes about the death. He chronicles the death of empires. And he said the common characteristic is that they have a military industrial intelligence complex that goes rogue, that can no longer be controlled. And that's certainly where we are. We perpetuate war, disastrous war. I mean, I just was reading about a review of McMaster's new book where he trashes Trump. This was in the New York Times, and they talked about his distinguished career as if Iraq wasn't a debacle, as if Afghanistan wasn't a complete catastrophe, as if Libya was. I mean, so these people are responsible for, I would argue, what's happened in the last two decades in the Middle East is probably even more damaging to the empire than Vietnam. It's probably the worst strategic decision in American history, for it's another worth another show. And yet, no one is held accountable. And in some ways, and I'm not a Trump supporter, but remember that Trump called out the Iraq war as a disaster. I mean, on the debate stage in front of Jeb Bush, he said what no one else was willing to say, by at least among the political class of either party.
Yeah. Not only that, is he gave the game away about how, he said, I used to be a donor. I used to come in and give them money and they did what I said. And so I think that's maybe another problem for the donor class and him. But he is also such a political novice that he will say a truth. So like if you listen to CNN, they'll tell you the reason why that the establishment and they all hate Donald Trump is because he went to Washington, D.C. and he started lying. If you think that the establishment hates a politician because he went to Washington, D.C. and started lying, I've got a vaccine I'd like to sell you. The reason why they hate Donald Trump is because he's such a political novice and they can't control him, that he every once in a while will tell a big truth the president's not supposed to tell. And the biggest one he told was when he was asked point blank, why are you leaving troops in Syria? And he said, for the oil secured, it's our oil, we're taking the oil. And you can't say that. You're supposed to that. So now the whole world saw the president say, give away the point of our foreign policy for the last 50 or 60 years is to invade smaller, weaker countries and steal their natural resources. He's supposed to say this is because Assad's oppressing his people and we're trying to keep the secure liberty for the. That's what he's supposed to say. And he didn't. He just gave the game away. He said the same thing about Venezuela recently at a campaign rally. He said, Venezuela was ready to fall. We could have had all that oil. We could had all that oil. And he just says it. And so those are the things that he is, as Aaron Maté says, that he puts an ugly face on imperialism. And that makes it tougher for them to do their imperialism, especially since they've demonized him as a white supremacist and a racist. It makes it much harder for them, so much easier for the military-industrial complex to have a guy like Barack Obama or a black woman like Kamala Harris. And this is why I said it'll be, you know, at least when a Republican's a president and he does wars, sometimes the Democrats will go and protest him, right? But what if it's Barack Obama? He dropped more bombs than George Bush. Nobody noticed. Nobody said anything. They gave him a peace prize, right? And Kamala Harris is set to do the exact same thing. So in that regard, it's worse. For if Kamala Harris becomes president, because the left goes to sleep when a Democrat is president, especially if it's a president of color.